and welcome to Encore. Encore is Near FM's Highlights of the Week programme. And on this week's edition, Norma Burke discusses the homeless situation here in Dublin with Ard Mhaire Micheál McDonagh on Northside Today. Later, Larry O'Toole is joined by Nancy Wallach on the Rocky Road, where they chat about the life of baritone Paul Robeson. And finally, Lakshmi is joined on Lifeline by Derek Devoy of Taxi Watch, a community-based initiative aimed at suicide prevention. But first, on this week's edition of Encore, it's Norma Burke on Northside Today.
So you're very welcome back to Northside Today and to Near FM. I'm joined now in the studio by Ard Mhaire Micheál McDonagh, who has very kindly come in today to discuss the homelessness situation in Dublin. Very welcome to Near FM, Ard Mhaire.
Thanks, and it's great to be here again.
And because you are, of course, an alumni of Near FM.
Indeed, yeah. I for a number of years I had a radio programme. I had a traditional music programme on the station, which I enjoyed very much. And of course, I'm a big fan of the station.
And so you're very familiar with our studios here in Coolock, which are actually a fantastic setup here with our three different studios.
They are indeed, yeah.
It's
and it's a tribute to
facility.
Everybody who volunteers. But I wouldn't be competent now to go behind the desk because it's like the technology has come on since I was here.
So you might press the buttons, which, like, unfortunately, happened in one part of the world over the weekend.
We won't talk about that.
We'll brush over that. But the reason that we are here today and to talk about a situation that has been dominating the headlines in the last months of 2018, which is the situation for the homelessness in both Ireland and in Dublin. Now, you have recently written to the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, and you've had a meeting with him to outline some of your thoughts on
that. That's right, yeah. Well, it's customary for the Ard Mhaire, the Lord Mayor of Dublin, to meet the Taoiseach, and that meeting took place last Monday, this day week, and the main issue that I wanted to highlight with him is the housing crisis, the housing emergency that we've had now for a number of years.
Now, just to stop you there, I mean, the language over what we're calling this is something that's being debated. Crisis is something that perhaps people have been billing it as. But to declare a national emergency which would activate European funding, you are saying that you do think this is
absolutely. I mean, if we've always said that whether it's declared an emergency or not, that the government should be saying to the EU that this is a critical situation, crisis, emergency, whatever you want to call it, that means that normally EU rules should not apply. For example, the restriction on government borrowing, the procurement rules, these things are, they are an obstacle to the government putting in place the type of major social and affordable housing programme that we need. But I think the problem is at a government level that unfortunately they're still wedded to a policy that has failed, and that's a market-driven, market-dominated policy.
Absolutely. And so in terms of your letter, I've got that here in front of me. I mean, you outline obviously the last set of statistics which came out just before Christmas. There are 3,333 children living in emergency accommodation, nearly 9,000 people overall. And as you point out, what you say in the letter is that it's the tip of a massive iceberg. And you refer to social housing and also affordable housing. Can you tell me what you mean? Obviously, there's the issue of people sleeping on the streets. That's one aspect of it. What are you highlighting here in your letter?
The housing crisis, the emergency, is by no means confined to to people on the streets, to people in hostels, or indeed to people in emergency accommodation, even though we now have 9,000. And that's a horrendous figure. But as I say, that is the tip of the iceberg. There are many, many thousands who are not properly housed, who are in housed in bad, overcrowded conditions. On Dublin City Council housing waiting list alone, we have some 20,000 applicants. Many of those would be families. So the crisis is really, really deep. There are many, many people who are not captured in the statistics because they may have, their income may be too high to actually go on the council housing waiting list, but rents are too high and they cannot afford a mortgage in the private sector, or indeed in some cases rents in the private sector. So they may be living with parents, they may be living with relatives or friends, and there's a huge tranche of people in those categories. So this crisis goes across the board. So we need social housing, we need council housing urgently. We also need affordable housing, and that means accommodation that's affordable to rent in the private sector and affordable to buy as well, because now we have people even on fairly reasonable incomes who have no hope at present of getting a mortgage to purchase their own home. So all of these issues need to be tackled, but the only way it will be tackled is by a government response that is comprehensive, led by a major social and affordable housing programme of construction and purchase of homes.
And in terms of, I mean, that's a long, I mean, do you see that as a medium to long term solution?
Absolutely, and but it must start now. It has to start as soon as possible. Now, the government has made a kind of a stuttering start to a certain extent, but nowhere near the programme that we need.
And so the Housing Minister, Owen Murphy, was on the RTE programme looking at this before Christmas. And I think he committed to 2,000 units over the course of the year, which was criticised by Inner City Helping Homeless. They said that was, I think, maybe a fifth of what's required.
That's right.
Do you think that what they're proposing in terms of units is reasonable?
No, it's far from enough. And there is general agreement among people who, you know, in the sector, you mentioned Inner City Helping Homeless, there are many other groups as well, and political parties, that we're looking at, we need a figure of about 10,000 social housing units and affordable housing provided every year. That is what we need at this stage. And the idea that, you know, 2,000 would be enough, and I mean, even that figure is questionable if that will be delivered, because, you know, there have been issues about the way the government has presented statistics. So we need a major step change in government policy. That's what's needed.
And where, you know, to ask maybe an obvious question, where's the money going to come from?
Well, we have estimated that the money is there in the current fiscal space, as it's called, but it's a matter of choices. Now, the current government is choosing to give tax breaks and tax cuts. They are choosing to go in that direction rather than to spend on essential infrastructure, essential not only social need but economic need, because it's a false economy if we do not solve the housing crisis on the basis of, oh, we don't, you know, we can't afford it. We can't afford not to, because it is now having a seriously bad effect on the economy in two ways. First of all, so much income is now being absorbed by high rents and mortgages. Excessive rents and excessive mortgages, that is taking money out of the economy, which is unproductive. It goes nowhere. And secondly, for Dublin in particular, there is a disincentive now for companies to invest in Dublin because of the housing situation. What happens to their workforce in terms of trying to find accommodation? And that is now generally recognised as a major problem. So our ability to attract inward investment is now being affected by the housing crisis.
Should we, though, as a country, when we're looking to bring new businesses into Ireland, and obviously Brexit has had some impact on that as well, I mean, we shouldn't be be so Dublin-centric, though, should we? You know, if housing's short in Dublin, you know, why don't we send them down to Kilkenny or Limerick or Galway and let them see?
Oh, yeah, I mean, I don't have a problem with that. And I don't go for this approach of Dublin versus the rest of the country. I think we need to act as a country. And certainly there is over-concentration of population in Dublin and of economic activity that needs to be spread around. At the same time, it's better to have inward investment in Dublin than not at all.
Sure.
And unfortunately, that's often the choice. These companies will either come to Dublin or not come to Ireland at all. While that is the case, we need to ensure that accommodation is provided. And I mean, there are also imaginative ways. In some cases, companies are willing to make a contribution to the housing situation, sometimes by providing housing for their own workforce. That would be a contribution. But the government needs to be much more proactive on this.
And that was Norma Burke, who was joined on Northside Today by Ard Mhíre Mícheál McDonagh. And you can hear the full version of that interview on Near FM podcasts. Next on Encore, Larry O'Toole is joined by Nancy Wallach on the Rocky Road, where they chat about the life of baritone Paul Robeson.
Nancy, now you're going to speak during the programme about Paul Robeson, but
yes,
about that particular.
Well, you know, I heard Kevin Barry's sung to me in New York, and I'm not Irish American or of Irish extraction, but my father used to sing to me as a lullaby because Paul Robeson popularized Kevin Barry and brought it to the attention of people in the United States, and it really became beloved by all kinds of people, freedom-loving people, people active in the trade union movement, anti-fascists. In fact, my father, which I have in common with Manus's father, my father left for the International Brigades from the United States, and it was so popular and well-known amongst the men who were leaving, which really I'm going to be speaking further tomorrow night about Paul Robeson's internationalism, which was this unity of 52 countries coming together to defend democracy and fight fascism in Spain. And each national group brought over, or in the course of battle, came up with their songs. And when the Americans would come up later after the Battle of Jarama Valley with a song penned by Woody Guthrie, Jarama. Mm-hmm. But before they had one, Kevin Barry was the song they brought over with them. And when Robeson came to Spain to sing later, he sang this to the Americans. So, of course, my father then heard it at the front in Spain. And he tried very much to, for instance, he would sing perhaps the peat bog soldiers in German to the anti-fascists who were fighting from Germany. And he made a point, really, of learning the languages in an authentic manner. Aside from his love of languages, it was part of his philosophy of communicating directly with people through their own language. Mm. So Kevin Barry has a special significance for those of us in the United States, too, and particularly those of us who would have some connection with the fight against fascism in Spain and the international brigades.
Mm-hmm. So, going back to your common link regarding the Spanish Civil War.
Yes.
And did you say there that Paul Robeson, he became a multilingual?
Yes, he did. As a matter of fact, and this was part of as he was really evolving politically, his outlook was evolving. He really began to incorporate folk music into his repertoire, and it was very important for him to learn the language of the people he was communicating with. In fact, he had such a love of it that in his autobiography, he mentions that had his life taken a different turn, which he could not have anticipated, he thought that that once his performing career was over, he would probably, he thought, have settled into being a professor of linguistics at a university in the United States. Yeah. Of course, we know that's not the turn his career took.
Yeah. He was a great, great man. Just going back to the Spanish Civil War, as I say, both of you have come, both your fathers, Michael O'Riordan, and his father, who I knew, and your father.
My father's name was Hi Wallach, and he left from the United States for the International Brigades.
Yeah.
And he was in the Battle of the Ebro, which Manus's father was in also, at different periods. My father was in the period of the retreats, and Manus's was when they were trying to advance and take it again.
So they may have met later at some conferences of veterans, but perhaps abroad. But they would have met.
Yes, I think so. But who my father did meet from Ireland is my father was in, besides the Ebro, he fought at Brunetti, at Teruel, which was the north pole of Spain, brutally cold weather. But outside of Gandesa, he was captured, and that was the same place that Frank Ryan was captured. And Ryan, of course, was the commander of the Connolly Column, which was fought alongside the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. And unfortunately, they both had the privilege of being the guest of the fascists at the International Brigade concentration camp. And my father would, you know, when he spoke about it, he said Frank Ryan, we don't want to speak about House Speaker Paul Ryan, but Frank Ryan was one of the people he most admired of all the people he met in Spain, his bravery. And he remembered Ryan giving them a lecture about James Connolly, and he really felt he was up to date on what was through this, the kind of what was going on all over the world through the kinds of people such as Frank Ryan that he met. And
brilliant,
he remembered the points he made about James Connolly, and it was, you know, you would rather not have that privilege, but it did stand out.
And that was Larry O'Toole, who was joined on the Rocky Road by Nancy Wallach. And finally, on this week's edition of Encore, Lakshmi is joined on Lifeline by Derek Devoy of Taxi Watch, a community-based initiative aimed at suicide prevention.
Derek Devoy, as I introduced him earlier, He has established a taxi watch, which is a group of volunteers and drivers who aim to help prevent suicide in their local community. So, hello, Derek. Are you there?
Hello, how are you?
Yeah. Can I hear
you?
Hi, hi. Good morning.
How are you doing?
Good. Could you tell us how you started this interesting group?
Yeah, how we started was I had been in a car crash in 2010, and I injured my back. The drunk driver ran into the back of me, and I went into hospital, and I had three different surgeries on my back. And each time I came out of hospital, I ended up with depression, and it was very, very bad. I had never had depression before. I didn't know about it. Didn't know anything about suicide, depression, or anything like that. And basically, at the end of it all, it just kept getting worse and worse and worse, and I tried to take my own life three times. So then what happened was I went eventually and got help. I finally admitted to myself I needed to get help, and I went and I spoke to the doctor, got counselling, and things got better, and I went back to work. And my first night back to work, I came across two people on a bridge in Kilkenny the same night, an hour apart, and they were threatening to take their own life. So I got out of the car and I spoke to them, and I got them into the car, and we got them help. So I just thought, what happens if I had said something different and they jumped? How would I live with that? Or what do you say to somebody that's suicidal? So I went away and I done a bit of research, and I came up with a course that was available by the HSE, Safe Talk and Assist. And I went and done those courses, and I found them brilliant. And I came back, and I asked all the taxi drivers in Kilkenny, would they come with me? And they did. And we set up Taxi Watch, and it just snowballed from there. It's in 10 different counties now, and we're going to New York, Belfast, London. It's just gone crazy, thank God.
Tell us about your experience when you were feeling so low, a little bit.
God, it was the worst time of my life ever. As I said, I never knew anything about depression. I thought anybody that had depression just needed to pull themselves together and get a grip on yourself. What's wrong with you? You couldn't be depressed. You're loaded. You've loads of money. You have a good job. You have a good wife, kids. What's wrong with you? Get a grip on yourself. And that's what I thought depression was, and I was ashamed to say that. But when it hit me, it was the worst time ever. I spent nearly 8-9 months in my bedroom. I couldn't come out of the bedroom. And I hid it from everybody. I was so ashamed of it. At the time, I was so ashamed of it. And I used to stay in bed. And I'd get up in the morning and I'd put on my suit. I'd head off to work. My kids would get ready and my wife would get ready for school. They'd head off and I'd go out the gate, turn around and come back in and take off my clothes and get back into bed. Just cry for the day. And I used to get up at 10 to 6 before my wife and kids came home from work and school. And I just pretend that nothing was wrong. And I was brilliant. I was the best actor in Ireland. But it was just making me worse and worse and worse. So I just needed to go get help. And I just snapped one day and had a row with somebody. And I wanted actually to kill them, to be quite honest with you. If I had got them, I probably would have killed them at the time. Thank God I didn't. And I came back then and I went to my doctor. And I just said, I need help. And I just fell onto the floor in the doctor's surgery. And I cried and cried and cried. And he was brilliant, Dr. Lee in Kilkenny. He was absolutely fantastic. And only for him I wouldn't be here, to be honest with you.
So you felt that you were alienated from everybody at the beginning. Did people know what happened to you?
No. Everybody knew I had an accident, but nobody knew that I had depression because I didn't let them know. I hid it from everybody. It was my own fault that I alienated myself, really. I just thought people would be better off without me. I was in severe problems with the mortgage. I couldn't pay the mortgage because I wasn't working for the last 4 years because I was in hospital with my back in and out. And everything just came down on top of me. And I tried to be, it's the stereotypical, it's I tried to be a big tough man and I tried to suck it all up and do it all myself. And I didn't want to ask for help. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed of myself. And there's no need. I know that now there's no need to be embarrassed. And it actually turned out the other way because when I did finally get okay and I'd set this up, all of a sudden all radio stations, TV stations, papers, everybody was ringing me. And I just said, right, do it. Just let them know what happened. So I told everybody that I was suffering from depression. I told them all on air, live on Kilkenny Radio. And it absolutely went the opposite way. Everybody gathered around me and everybody helped me. It was great. It was absolutely great. It was like somebody took their foot off my chest. It was brilliant.
So you actually opened up a huge area where people were so silent about.
Nobody talks. Men don't talk, and they should.
So
that's just the way it is.
Could you tell us how you start, these taxi bots, and then how did you rescue people? How do you do it?
Yeah, what we do is all the taxi drivers have got trained in Safe Talk or the Assist course. And what they do is they go out on the night to work when they're working, and they drive around. And in Kilkenny, there's certain areas at the time where people were going to take their own life down by the river or wherever it was in woods. And our cars were out all hours of the night. So we would see everything around the town and see what happens. And people were getting into the cars and they were telling us that they felt so low and they wanted to kill themselves. And they just opened up to us. It was great because everybody knew that we were there and we were willing to listen to them and talk to them about suicide and ask them what's the problem and get them help. So we done that and we just go up and down now and looking for people. And since we started in 2014, we've 200 people that we physically stopped from taking their life. Now, there's probably thousands and thousands out there more that have rang, and we've got them counselling all over Ireland and in all areas of Ireland. In Kilkenny alone, we use Chalk Tom, which is a free counselling service, because people can't afford.
Yes, that's a big thing, yes.
Yeah, that's a big thing. Like, people can't afford it, but they don't realise that there's actually free counselling out there. And people just don't think it's free, or how do I don't have the money to go. And at the time, myself, when I was poor, I didn't have any enough money coming in to even pay for my own medication, never mind go to counselling. So free counselling is fantastic, and that should be available, and it is available with the HSC. I understand that, but it just takes too long to get it.
How do you avail of it? How do you go about it?
Well, what we do, Pieta House is out there. in the House as free counsel. So sad up in Dundalk as counsel. And there's counsel, free counsel all over Ireland. If you Google free counsel, you'll see the places. Or if you go onto our website, taxiwatch.ie, we have a full entire list of all the places in Ireland that you can get your free counsel. And you just ring them up, make an appointment, go in. The good thing is people, myself at the time, people don't, they think that counsellors are kind of going to look down on you, or it's going to be kind of like a doctor or a teacher and a student, but it's not. They're absolutely so. They just want to help you, and like a lot of counsellors themselves have gone through this. That's how they got into counselling, because they've been there themselves and they know exactly. So they don't judge you. And that's what's the main thing for me was, I didn't want to be judged. I didn't want somebody thinking I was crazy or was mad or I was anything like that. Because at the time I felt that way, that's the way it was, but it wasn't. And when I went to counselling, the first session I felt a bit weird, because I'd never told anybody. But then after that, it was just, I couldn't shut up. I just told them everything. It was great.
When you meet someone, like say on the bridge, how do you go about,
Well, the first thing we ask is, are you okay? That's the first thing we ask every single person. Every one of our drivers asks somebody, are you okay? You would know that they're not okay because it's 3:30 in the morning, they're down by the riverbank, it's pitch dark, they're on their own. So you just go over and ask them. And since we ask everybody that we've asked, not one single person has ever said, oh yeah, glad, I'm grand, I'm just getting a bit of fresh air. Nobody has said that. They have all just burst into tears and said, no, I'm not okay, I need help. And we would take them then, and if they're extremely bad, like sometimes we've had maybe 5 or 6 people that had to be restrained by the guards, that they were just adamant that they wanted to take their life. And now, thank God they didn't, and we see them since, and I see them around Kilkenny every day. Like when I'm in around Kilkenny driving taxi, they come in and they'd wave at you, they'd give you a little wink or squeeze your hand as they're walking past or whatever.
You have been asked to support other organisations, isn't it? The Derry Drivers, they do something before?
Yeah, the Derry Drivers started up there. They've changed, actually, now. They've gone more into... they're using defibrillators as well, so they're going around... In Derry, actually, they have 2 ambulances, believe it or not, for the whole of the county. Yeah. So if somebody, God forbid, gets a heart attack, it's actually a taxi driver that will arrive first with the defibrillator. Which is completely and utterly wrong, but look, that's just the way it is. But everybody kind of has joined up together, and everybody shares everybody else's posts on Facebook, all these services. There's girls in Limerick who go out from 5 up to 5 a.m. in the morning, and they drive around. So if you're feeling depressed or suicidal or whatever, you can ring them and they'll call out to you and they'll have a chat with you, and that helps people, and just talking about it helps. And people are afraid to talk to their own family, so talking to a stranger is fantastic. So yeah, but we would work with like the Samaritans. We would use them and share their number an awful lot, like, and get people to ring them up and just talk, just get it off your chest, and you'll feel better for that moment, for a start.
That was Encore for this week. Encore will be back here on Near FM at the same time next Sunday afternoon. That's 4 p.m. Have an amazing week. Talk soon. Bye-bye.